Y'all know what Friday nights are like. We've got to be by the book tonight. You don't have a customer? I want you to clean, clean, clean. Let's get to work.
This is Officer Daniels
with the police department.
I have a woman here saying one of your employees took money out of her purse.
You have a young lady who works at the register, about 19 years old, blonde.
Becky, come with me.
I swear, I didn't take anything. I don't know what's going on here. I'm just trying to do my job.
Calm down for me, okay?
You don't realize what kind of trouble you're in. We need to find the money, but I'll need your help till I can get down there. We really have two choices here.
He's saying he'll have to take you to jail.
Or what we could do is have you strip search her right now.
I could strip search you here.
No. No.
Craig, it's interesting with this movie Compliance because you've made a movie that doesn't just make people uncomfortable. I'm sure that word comes up a lot. Disturbing.
Yeah.
Disturbing comes up probably a lot as well. But based on some of the things I've read, and I can certainly imagine this, it has the potential to really actually anger people. It provokes pretty vitriolic responses. How have you dealt with that?
It does. I mean, it's important, especially in kind of like talking about it on the radio with people, is to say that that's not the only reactions that it garners. You know, like people are engaged, and a lot of people are responding really positively to the movie as well. But it's a movie that I made fundamentally because I was looking at something that, when I saw these true stories that the film's based on, my immediate reaction was one of, well, I would never do that. You know, like very quickly was that. And really, the movie in some ways is a kind of about speaking about, after a few days of that, I had really sat with the story and it kind of resonated with me, and I thought about it days later and actually thought more about my reaction to the story, which was so immediate. And had such a level of like condescension that I kind of didn't want to even admit to myself. Like, you know, I quickly was like putting them in a place that was different than me.
Right.
So that I would be safe from that. And it forced me to kind of really reflect on like if I was being honest with myself about, you know, would I do that? Would I actually ever do that? Like, am I 100% sure that I'm that guy? Have I never been in a situation where, like, a boss has asked me to do something that I didn't agree with and I still did even though I didn't agree with it and felt like I couldn't speak up or say no?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, like, when people have these, you know, strong reactions to the film, I definitely think that, I don't know, I think it's coming out of all of that type of stuff.
Sure.
You know?
Certainly you had to be aware that you were making a challenging film and one that might be divisive, but have you been surprised at all? Have you been taken aback by any of the criticism?
I have, just in the sense that I knew that I was going to like leave a certain portion of the audience, you know, piece of the audience would not like this kind of movie, right? This is like a type of movie that you can choose to either go see Magic Mike or you can choose to see a movie like this, you know? And I guess the most surprising thing has been that I thought that maybe I wouldn't necessarily hear from as many of them as that. I feel like some people are seeing the film who maybe are not prepared for it in some way or shape or form. But I really didn't make this movie because I was like telling a bunch of people what I thought. Like, I genuinely like find all of the stuff incredibly interesting and fascinating. And this is a story that is to me interesting simply because on the surface, it's very black and white, what's wrong and what's right and what people did wrong. And then as you think about it for any given amount of time, it starts to become much more nuanced and complicated.
Right.
And so any sort of reaction to the movie is kind of valid in a certain sense as well. And I'm open to all of it, honestly.
Well, it's interesting. You touched on what for me has been the most curious response, where people do automatically sort of detach themselves and say, well, I would never do that. I wouldn't go as far as some of the characters do, or I would never put myself in that situation. I wouldn't let myself be victimized the way the character does. And that is something fascinating because as you watch the film and as you learn more about it, you realize that this isn't an isolated incident. There were multiple cases of this happening that this is based on. Certainly there's a history of psychological experiments that do show the human capacity to absolve yourself of responsibility and follow orders and commit heinous acts basically because you were told to do so. And based on what you've been saying so far, it sounds like that clearly for you was something you wanted to explore here.
Absolutely wanted to explore. I was very fascinated in just that in a kind of a general sense. And so it's interesting, you know, that reactions to the film that are immediately distancing. I think that it's a bit of like, I don't want to look in that closet, please.
Absolutely.
Of a situation. You know, it's funny because it also is built in where it's like, no, like the reaction to someone who I might say something to would, I think, pretty quickly be like, no, I just, like, I don't care if it's based on a true story. I don't believe that. Like,
right.
I don't believe it. Which maybe, you know, maybe for those people, I didn't necessarily make the film in a way that it works. Or maybe it's just uncomfortable and they really don't like to think about mm-hmm. that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
and it, you know, it's fascinating because it's like, I feel that letting yourself be a person that's at least open to identifying that this type of thing is possible is in some ways the first step to making sure that you aren't that person.
I agree. I think it's a cautionary tale on a lot of levels. We're talking with Craig Zobel about his new film, Compliance. I think it's interesting, too, how you take great care early on and very subtly, I think, set up some character information that ends up factoring into the story in a major way. Certainly as people were talking about maybe sit back and say, well, I would never do that. Well, maybe you wouldn't, but maybe you wouldn't be in this specific scenario that these characters are in their circumstances. And I love how you set up the manager character, Sandra, played by Ann Dowd, very well by Ann Dowd. And early in the film, we see that she's already sort of in some hot water, that she's already very sensitive about the fact that maybe she's not the authoritarian figure she'd like to be, that her employees don't take her as seriously as they should. She's not hard enough on them. And she's already hiding something from the district manager or from the big boss. So then when these circumstances happen, it's kind of a perfect storm that she ends up following these orders and trying to sort of prove herself. I think what you're saying then by watching the film is not that everybody would do what she does in this scenario. Of course, that wouldn't be the case. But certain people, and we can see ourselves in them and see other people we know in them, might be susceptible in those instances.
Like, isn't this an empathetic place to, like, yeah, like, which is it was an intention. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it, for me, the movie was about the only kind of reason to do it was in some ways to say, like, okay, well, what are the human behaviors that are – what is something real and playable, like in an acting term, playable, performable things that you could actually see and recognize as like, yes, I recognize that I have been flustered and made this sort of mistake before. And like what culmination of like a bunch of those, which I think you're right. I mean, I think it is like a perfect storm is a good term, like a bunch of different things that kind of all add up to – making decisions without thinking about them and then getting yourself into a crazy situation like
yeah,
this.
Yeah, that's fascinating too because, of course, I was thinking about it in terms of just the characters. I wasn't thinking about it in terms of being an actor or actress and having to have playable circumstances that it has to make sense to the people you're directing as well. It can't just be, well, this really happened, so go and do
go
it.
Go do it. Well, just do it. Do it more like it really happened.
No, couldn't pull that off. That movie right. wouldn't be any good.
Right. So that was actually the whole reason to make a movie out of it was to sit down with other actors and say, like, I think that these are some of the reasons, maybe, and hear from all of them, like, well, this is how I could wrap my head around that. And, you know,
yeah,
it was part of the curiosity that we all
sure.
had. Yeah.
This is your second film after Great World of Sound, 2007. Watching them back to back, I actually was catching up with Great World of Sound just this past weekend. It occurs to me that, of course, both films are essentially con movies. You've got an authority figure who's authorizing the scheme
sure.
to manipulate people, take advantage of people. You have the middleman. In Great World of Sound, the middleman is our sympathetic hero who comes to be more of a sympathetic hero, I guess I should say, who is actually carrying out the con. And then you have the victims. In both cases, you see that dynamic very clearly. So I'm curious where that interest comes from with you.
You know, it's funny. You kind of pick things that fascinate you, and then later on you like have to kind of look at them in some sort of bigger picture thing.
Right.
And you know, I certainly, both of these seemed like movies where I honestly think like the kind of shortest and quickest answer to that question is that like I see a lot of conflict in those situations, and I see a lot of a type of conflict that I don't necessarily feel gets covered all the time in film.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting because there feels like there's ground to cover in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
But I think on a bigger sense, I also have an interest in, you know, in a con like situation, there is kind of, I fundamentally believe that when people meet other people, your initial assumption is that everybody's like going to do the right thing and is going to be a cool person.
Mm-hmm.
And that I have a lot of sympathy for like people kind of like believing that part of the world. I want to believe that too. I want to believe that everybody is like doing the right thing. And so like there is, I do have a lot of empathy for people, the frustration of being tricked.
Right.
Is what it is, really. But I also have a fascination with the weird kind of rationalizations that you have, that people make. I always kind of like think about, nobody like imagines themselves as a bad guy.
No.
You know what I mean? Like people who do these cons are not thinking that they're doing, or they're lessening the consequences for themselves.
They've justified it in some way to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Which is fascinating in its own way, you know, mm-hmm. like, so there's just a lot to kind of talk about in these types of situations, I feel like.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're talking with the optimistic-seeming Craig Zobel. And I say that because getting to this question of how you seem fascinated by this con scenario and cases where people do end up as victims, I'm wondering, do you consider yourself to be a cynical person, or do you ultimately come to see human nature as something where you can focus on the positive and say, well, at least in both instances, someone does finally speak up. Someone does develop a conscience, and we should look at it that way, that someone says, finally, enough. Or do you care?
Yeah.
Do you care about what you're trying to necessarily say in a big picture about human nature?
I guess I'm more kind of still trying to figure it all out, too, in a way. Like, I hope that I'm not a complete cynic, and I hope that the movies don't come off that cynical. Like, I do believe that we're good. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I want to close by asking you a question I'm sure you've heard plenty of times with regard to this film, and it has to do with the graphic nature of it, or the fact that actually I would say you're overall pretty restrained with it. I think you leave a lot up to the imagination. It certainly becomes more of a psychological horror film than it does become what we might expect in terms of nudity or violence or anything like that.
Sure.
That said, obviously the question has come up, and I don't know if you saw the Atlantic article talking about Killer Joe and your film Compliance, and having just seen Killer Joe and really responding positively to it, that's something we talked about when we reviewed it, this notion of watching female characters having to literally bear themselves in front of the camera. And the writer of that article ultimately came down against you and William Friedkin, saying it did seem exploitative. It did seem like there was something wrong, even as the writer felt like they understood what you were going for in terms of making the audience perhaps complicit, making us voyeurs. What I want
and
to know from you is,
how was it exploitative?
Well,
I mean, completely. I understand the
sure.
way we're going with this, but just to, can you like be specific about it? Because it's curious. Here's the thing: I think that this stuff is really fascinating to talk about too,
mm-hmm.
and I think that it actually brings up bigger questions about like nudity in film, and like I think all of this is like really useful, good conversations mm-hmm. to be having too. And it's like I made decisions that I attempted to make. I mean, you said restrained. I attempted to make decisions that would, like, be on the right side of something. And I would love to know if eventually that I wasn't on the right side of those things. I reject the idea that I, like, wasn't thinking about it, because I was. Do
no.
you know what I mean?
So no. it's like, and I don't think they're accusing you of that. The article itself seems very kind of mixed on it. But I think the fact that when you could have clearly made choices to obscure some of the nudity, the camera, the viewer, didn't necessarily need to see your lead actress the way that we do. And was something gained from that, or was actually something lost from that, is what the article is ultimately posing. My concern primarily actually is what you said about how much you thought about it. I'm sure you did a lot. I want to know
the only thing you see in the film is her topless.
True.
Very specific to be, you know, now
right.
we have to talk about like how much nudity do you see? And it's like, it's so not even bare buttocks or anything like that. It's just toplessness, which is, you know, which I feel funny that we have to have this conversation in some ways, but I also think that it's important to kind of go down the road and say like, all right, it begs a bigger question about nudity in film and all this
exactly.
stuff. It's like, I did think it was important to see some
mm-hmm.
In the sense that I do think that there is some gravity to it, that you could even distance yourself further from the story and put yourself in a place where you're not in that room with
mm-hmm.
them. And your horse is comfortably a little bit higher the more distance you have.
Yeah.
And I think that it does something to stop that. we tried to be as tasteful as we could about a story about
very unsavory subject matter.
And a story about, you know, gender and power dynamics and how people manipulate authority in gender relationships. And so it's about that stuff. I mean, it's about all of this stuff. And so it's like, yeah, I guess it's funny. Like, I'm happy to talk about that all day, honestly, because I ultimately, if the decision is that it's that I kind of made the bad decisions there, that's fine. But it's funny, a lot of people see this film and who have seen it more than one time or saw it maybe at Sundance or when it first came out and then are revisiting it and discussing it with me, say like, but you re-edited it, you cut stuff out. And I'm like, no, I didn't.
The recollection of it
out.
Is that it's more graphic than it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can
Which
see that because of our imaginations and because I think the room is so charged and we do feel like we're there in the room that we remember it in a more horrifying way.
The words that everybody is saying, the words that the actors are saying to each other are very like charged and,
absolutely.
And stressful. And I think that is weirdly adding to the feeling of exploitation in a visual way, which is just interesting. I don't know.
Well, it is fascinating subject matter. It's a fascinating film. I wish we had all day to talk about it. Craig Zobel, thanks so much for your time. Best of luck with the movie.
Thank you.
So here's what happened. My girlfriend Abby and I moved in together. She's great. And my sister Janet got engaged.
You're next.
Coming your way, baby. Batter up.
And everyone started talking about marriage.
How long have you and Abby been together?
8 years.
I don't remember being so long. That's ridiculous.
And that night,
Abby!
I started walking in my sleep.
There's a jackal in the room.
Come back to bed.
How long has this sleepwalking been going on?
I don't think it's that serious.
As things with my girlfriend got more tense, my sleepwalking got more dangerous.
You did it, Mac. First place.
Thank you!
This is the first time I remember thinking, maybe I should see a doctor. And then I thought, maybe I'll eat dinner. I went with dinner.
You know, Mike, even though I'm on public radio, I am shamefully not up to speed with what's going on with public radio.
Oh, yeah.
So a lot of people know you from This American Life The Moth. And the first time I actually became aware of you, the first time I heard you was on Mark Maron's podcast on the 200th episode of WTF.
Where I interviewed him.
Exactly. And so that was a lot of fun. And then the first time I saw you was just a couple of months ago here this summer on Lena Dunham's Girls on HBO.
Girls, yeah.
I think it was the third episode. And you're in a scene. It's just one scene, very memorable scene. That not only was my favorite scene of that episode, and maybe the whole season, but one of the funniest things I've seen all year in anything. Frankly, it was just hilarious, where basically the setup is she's desperate for a job. She's interviewing with you. It's going really well. It couldn't be going better. You guys are just really connecting and finishing each other's sentences, and it's really funny. And then she just takes it a step too far.
Yeah.
And I just have to ask you about it because I love that scene so much. I really just want to know how that scene kind of came about, how much of that just happened, how much of it was really written and on the page ahead of time, and how much fun was it to shoot?
It was a really well-written scene. I'm friends with Lena. She was very instrumental in the making of my film. I saw Tiny Furniture and her film, and we became friends. And she read a lot of drafts of Sleepwalk With Me and gave notes on it. And then when she was making her series, she said, we have this part and it's this funny scene and here's how it goes. And I did it. And then we ended up improvising quite a bit. And I think a lot of that ended up being in the final product. But as written, it's hilarious too. I mean, it's just a funny scenario and she's a brilliant writer and a great director. I mean, the way that she was able to direct me, and being in the scene at the same time it was a good learning experience for me because that's what I ended up doing in my film. I'm the star of my film and then I direct it.
Was there anything in particular that you can share that you really remember taking away from watching her do that helped you on your film?
Just utter calm. Lena is a very self-possessed person and she just has confidence about what she wants and she's not afraid to ask for it and she has real vision.
You showed up again as a scene stealer. This time I recognized you in Your Sister's Sister.
Recently
Lynn Shelton on the show and Mark Duplass as well. Big fan of that movie and their work. again, a scene stealer. You're kind of in scene there at the beginning of the film, but it's really funny where you're giving a eulogy of sorts to someone who's passed away.
I hope that doesn't become my new reputation as the scene stealer actor.
We're going to get to your movie, I promise. This is it for other people's work. But just talk about that experience working with them. You actually had an interesting credit, and I didn't write it down, but at the end of the film, they listed you as kind of one of the
creative consultant, I think, is what they did, but which was very generous. I mean, that's... That Lynn was very generous to offer that, but certainly I didn't ask for it. But it just because it's an improvised film,
mm-hmm.
and that scene was, it was an eighth of a page on the page, and then we improvised all that stuff, and it was for me seeing the film was really shocking because I've improvised. Since college, I was in an improv group. I was cast my freshman year at Georgetown in this group, and we used to make pilgrimages to Chicago. My improv group would make road trips, and we would come and we'd go to Improv Olympic,
kind of the mecca,
Second City, right. And Annoyance Theater, and we would see everything. We would just see every show, and as a matter of fact, the first show I ever saw at Second City was called Paradigm Lost, and it had Tina Fey. Rachel Dratch, Scott Adsit, and Kevin Dorff, who are just four of the finest improvisers there are. And anyway, so I've been improvising for a long time. But then I went on to move to New York and have a group at UCB Theater called Little Man. It was myself and Nick Kroll and a bunch of other comedians and actors. But to see it filmed.
Yeah.
To see your improvisation filmed and then – that it exists on the big screen for the rest of time. It was actually shocking.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. Well, let's get to Sleepwalk With Me, your new film where you are the writer and the star and the director of this movie, telling a very personal tale. And as I was watching it, I'm a big Woody Allen fan. I couldn't help but think about Annie Hall.
Of course,
where
yeah.
you've got obviously a relationship film and a film about the a relationship in bloom already, but then kind of disintegrating before our eyes a little bit, but also the direct address to the camera.
Mm-hmm.
The scene in the film where the sleep doctor, I'm forgetting his name, shows up.
Dr. Dement, yeah.
Yeah, is talking to you, recalled Marshall McLuhan showing up at the theater.
Oh, yeah, sure.
There a little
yeah.
bit. So was Annie Hall an influence on you?
Oh, yeah. I think it's an influence on all
everybody.
Things that came after it.
Any romantic comedy.
Yeah. Every book, every movie, every television show. But yeah, for me particularly, like the films that really interest me and are just films that make me feel and laugh. You know, it's a really simple qualification for me for movies and like James Brooks movies I love. You know, Broadcast News in terms of endearment. Annie Hall, Manhattan, that whole – Hannah and Her Sisters, that whole era I just love. Sideways and you know the Alexander Payne mm-hmm. films and Lena Dunham's film Tiny Furniture. I mean that's just sort of the goal. But with Annie Hall was definitely a template because it's also a movie about a breakup.
Yeah,
and it was like how can you make a breakup funny, how can you make dangerous kind of death-defying levels of sleepwalking funny also.
So, Matt, we heard about the Dust Buster Olympics. You know, so Linda, can you get the book in your purse? Could you get the book for me, please? Yeah, I picked this up for you, The Promise of Sleep. Got one for myself as well.
Oh, thanks.
Can I see? It's great, Dr. Penniman. That's exactly the kind of thing we need.
There's some dangerous situations you can get yourself into. You ought to see a specialist.
It was very minor.
It wasn't minor.
Well, I put in a call to Dr. Latham. He conducts these overnight sleep studies.
I appreciated that, but right now I'm really busy.
With what? Folding napkins into triangles?
This just doesn't seem like a dinner conversation to me.
You know, Matthew, you say you're going to go see the doctor. You don't. You say you want to be a comedian. You're a bartender. I mean, pick a goddamn plan and stick with it.
He's kidding, but he's not... as funny as you.
I mentioned Mark Maron earlier, the podcast. He does play a small role in this film, but a
yeah.
pivotal role where you're
he plays
comedian.
Mark Mulhern.
I want to ask you about that in a moment, too. But it's a key role because he plays the veteran comedian, and you're trying to get your feet wet. You're on the road, and you're not doing particularly well. And you say something that's really kind of vulnerable and shows a side of you that's really personal. And he says, why don't you go up on stage and
say that? Yeah, why don't you say that?
And then that's where... the film takes off and your career in the film starts to take off because you finally have found your voice. Was there anybody like that for you in real life who gave you that kind of advice or really made you have that epiphany?
Well, Mark Maron, not Mark Mulhern, actually was one of those people, among others. I mean, my first manager was this guy named Lucian Hold, and he was the manager. He was the talent booker for the comic strip on the Upper East Side, which is kind of a legendary club for 30 years, you know. So he booked, he's passed away now, but he had booked, you know, Chris Rock for the first time, Jerry Seinfeld for the first time, Ray Romano. And one of the things he said to me that was really pivotal in my life is he said, you know, if you write about yourself, no one can steal it. And as a comedian, that's a really hard thing, is there's a lot of joke stealing, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of, there's frustration because we're all kind of swimming in the same pond to some degree, same topics. And if you, you know, I talk about sleepwalking on stage. I talk about all these things, you know, in my book and on stage, I talk about having a tumor in my bladder when I was 19 and going to the doctor and dealing with that. And I feel like the more specific you get to your own life, the less likely it is that anyone else is going to do something like it.
We're talking with Mike Birbiglia, the writer, director, star of the new movie Sleepwalk with me. And you mentioned Mark Mulhern. You do add this layer of artifice to the film where it's clearly your story in many ways, though I'm sure there's a lot that you add or embellish. But you did decide to alter the names a little bit. Instead of Mike Birbiglia, you're Matt Panamiglia.
Yep, and Matt Panamiglia, yeah, which is, of course, a joke.
And what was the reason, though, behind that?
We kind of – I mean, Ira and I talked that through. And
Ira Glass from This American
Ira
Life.
Ira Glass, yeah, who was a co-writer, and Seth Barish and Joe Birbiglia, who are co-writers of the screenplay. Mm-hmm. And we talked through, like – you know, there's a lot of autobiographical or semi-autobiographical films historically, and the ones that we wanted to emulate more were more like Annie Hall as opposed to, you know, Private Parts, which is Howard Stern's autobiographical film, which I love, actually. I love both of those films, but I felt like with Annie Hall, he was able to have the name Alvy Singer, which is, you know, it's a little bit of a goof on his own name. And then Diane Keaton is Annie. I mean, calls her Annie in real life, and people call her that. And that her Hall was her maiden name.
Right.
Yeah. And so it was a little bit of that. We were like, what we feel like we're doing is more in the vein of Annie Hall than Private Parts, even though we like both of those movies.
So you are trying to set a clear signal that a lot of this is true, but it's not all true, and we are having some fun with it, and there is this layer there.
Yeah, and I always tell people the things – when people ask me what's true, I say the things that you wouldn't expect to be – could be true are true.
Yeah.
And the stuff that is kind of minutia and you wouldn't even think about is probably made up or fudged for timeline or just convenience.
I actually – before this interview, I read what you had to say with the AV Club, though I think it was from 2 or 3 years ago. You did an interview there, and you said something really interesting. You said, when I started out, I was like a character of myself. In some ways, it's so shameful when I look back on it. I'm like, why couldn't I just be me? Now I'm so transparent, it's a joke. I don't know where I'm going to go from here. So that was a few years ago.
Why did I say that?
Where have you gone from here? And what are the pitfalls of putting yourself out there so transparently?
It's interesting because it makes it more challenging. The more you put yourself out there, the more you have to say, what's next? What else can I say? What else can I what else can I do? And I think honestly, like, you just have to dig deeper. It's funny, whenever I've worked on stories with Ira Glass for This American Life, we've done about 6 or 7 stories over the years. We did that story about how I got in a car accident. I was hit by a drunk driver and made to pay for the drunk driver's car.
It's
called
Return. Mark Maron, wasn't it?
Of that. Yeah. It was on this episode of This American Life called Return to the Scene of the Crime.
Oh, yeah. I did hear that recently.
Whenever I do stories with Ira, it's really interesting because I'll come to him and I'll say, I have this story, I have this story, I have this story. And then he'll go, it's okay. And then I'll say, well, I did have this thing happen, but I would never say it on stage or publicly. And then I'll say it, and you know, like that story, the car accident story, was like that, and, And of course, always those are the stories where he says, yeah, that's the one we're going to do. You know, and I'm like, ah, I don't know. I'm going to have to run this past a bunch of people and my wife and my friend Andy and make sure this is okay.
Come up
and,
with some clever names.
Yeah, exactly. But those are the stories that are interesting, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. They've proven to be so far. What then are specifically the challenges for you of taking what you've done on radio and on the stage off Broadway and bringing it to a film?
It's, you know, in film, it's just very visual.
Yeah.
And fortunately, we had this tremendous cinematographer named Adam Beckman, who had actually shot the This American Life TV series, who brought a lot of innovative ideas for how to shoot these really elaborate dream sequences on a budget. You know, we shot the film for like less than $1 million.
Wow.
You know, the upside of that is that there weren't a lot of kind of studios and fingers kind of coming in and saying, we want it like this. We want it like this. We want to appeal to this demographic more. You know, it was just us.
Yeah.
It was just us kind of making these decisions. And the obstacles were making the film cinematic and making it visual. And that's the thing that I feel like I'm most proud of, is that it does – you know, it captures something visual, which is, you know, dreams, which we've all seen in films before, of course, but sleepwalking, which I don't feel like I've seen. I mean, I feel like there's the kind of the honeymooners cliche of the guy with the arms in front of his body as he's walking and like a zombie,
right?
Like the zombie walk thing.
Yeah.
And then you've got like olive oil in the Popeye cartoons in the construction site.
There's nothing particularly menacing about it, or
no. And so we tried to capture what it actually is like to sleepwalk. And
it's interesting because watching it, I was thinking about some moments from my own life. I'm on here on Film Spotting. I'm on my third co-host, and when the other two hosts left, they were 4 years apart. And in both cases, amicable splits. But it was such a change in my life that mm-hmm. I actually went through a phase of about 2 weeks where I would wake up in the middle of the night and I thought I was dying. I was choking. I was actually gasping for air. I thought something was in my throat. And I would get up and I would kind of run down the hall as if I was trying to get this out of my throat to breathe. And my wife was freaking out. Like, what is wrong with you? You know, I mean, it's amazing how those things from your life can subconsciously start to creep in and affect you when you sleep. And so what we see in the film is you dealing with it, or not so much dealing with how that's happening. You're kind of in denial about it.
Mm-hmm.
Why were you so much in denial about it versus accepting that you had to look into this a little bit and examine it?
I say in the film, at this point in the film, I had just fallen off. I'd sleepwalked up onto a like a cupboard in my living room, and then I'd fallen off it and landed on the floor, and
yeah.
I was bleeding. And I say in the film, you know, at this point I thought maybe I should see a doctor, and then I thought maybe I'll eat dinner, and I went with dinner for years, you know. And in real life, I think that that's pretty similar. It's convenience, and it's also – I feel like the denial of the character has a lot to do with being a people pleaser. I feel like you don't want to rock the boat.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to make trouble. You know, it's like – and that's the same thing in his relationship. He knows that he and his girlfriend from his college sweetheart shouldn't be together. But it's just – it opens just a can of worms. And maybe if I just see this through, it'll work itself out. That's like the greatest – that's the greatest lie that we all tell ourselves all the time. This will work itself out.
Yeah. And that idea, that notion of just kind of hoping it will work out, and I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings – I don't want to spoil anything. It comes back in a major way.
Oh, yeah.
In this film, certainly. But there is a great moment. Speaking of visual moments, though it isn't something that certainly involved probably some intricacy with the camera, Lauren Ambrose in the film, great actress, plays your girlfriend in this movie. And there's just the moment where you kind of know, I guess to go back to Annie Hall, it's the moment when they know they've got a dead shark on their hands, right, is when they're at a wedding and taking a family picture, and it comes time to have your girlfriend come into the photo, and you just have that awkward moment where the look on her face and the look on your face says it all.
They ask me, do you want Abby in the photo? And I just pause.
Yeah.
And then my dad says, of course he does. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's
– but how did you sort of massage that beat visually on
camera? That was
very
difficult. It's interesting that you should ask about that. That was a very challenging thing to get on film, because that was based on a real-life incident, and it was in the one-man show.
Mm-hmm.
But it was – it was very delicate. And it was a feat of cinematography on the part of Adam, and then a feat of editing from our editor Jeffrey Richman, who edited The Cove and Sicko. He brought a lot of innovative ideas to the film that really make it what it is. But yeah, that was a hard thing to get across because very subtle. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of kind of tight shots but also you have to go wide because you need to understand the spatial relationship.
Sure. And you can't over communicate how dramatic it is. You do have to be subtle with it.
Yeah, and I think actually what sells it particularly is the scene right after it where they're driving home in the car, mm-hmm. and they're just not talking. And that was just like, I mean, we were just driving around in Brooklyn, no one else in the car, just me and Lauren and Adam Beckman, our cinematographer, riding with the camera rigged on the car. Uh-huh. And then he was just riding focus with the monitor himself with no assistant.
Wow.
In the car. I mean, just
– yeah.
I mean, it's the three of us and we, you know, made that whole scene. And
that's just amazing.
It was absurd because that's actually one of my favorite shots in the whole movie.
Yeah.
And he actually pulls focus manually on between me and Lauren. Uh-huh. as we're driving.
Wow.
And it was just one of those we shot for about 10 minutes and captured a bunch of stuff and then went with that.
You talked about improvising even though the scene was really well written with Lena Dunham in that episode from Girls. How much goofing around, how much going with what was on the page and then improvising did you do with this film?
Well, it was very targeted improvisation. So in other words, there are certain scenes that have to be a certain way for the construction of the narrative to work. But then the scene with the comedians hanging out, that's pretty much all improvised. It's me and Wyatt Cenac, Henry Phillips, Jesse Klein,
yeah.
who are all comedian friends of mine. And what I really wanted from that was I just wanted to feel like a bunch of friends hanging out. And because we wanted to see the character, Matt Pendimiglio, to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted everybody to know in the audience, like, this is where he should be. You know, I literally wrote in the script, if we ever release the script, you'll see that, you know, the comedians are hanging out. Matt knows, and I wrote in caps, all caps, these are his people.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's all I wanted.
I actually had a crazy gig once where these two Orthodox Jews had asked me if I would perform at, like, their art gallery.
Yeah.
They told me there were going to be hundreds of people there. And then I go, and it's
okay.
Just...
Yeah, go for it.
It's just their apartment. And
yeah.
It's just them.
So it wasn't like a show.
No.
It was like a conversation.
It was more like a quiet conversation.
I did this one show. It was in the parking lot of a Home Depot. The only people we're performing for are, like, the migrant workers who are just hanging out there. I'm going up last, and I'm watching every other comic just eat it, just tank. But I'm thinking, like, I want to get some response from these people. Like, I should close strong. What Spanish do I know? And I'm like, I know, I'll say long live the immigrant. And I'm like, all right, everybody, this has been fun. Viva la migra, which is long live the immigration police.
For me, like, that's what improvisation does to films, is when you have something that you can't quite express with dialogue, you want a magic, you want something that is so real it's you can taste it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's I think that that's what it does. And,
yeah.
And Wyatt Cenac improvises that whole story about
Home Depot.
Performing in the parking
really
lot
funny.
Of a Home Depot.
Yeah, and Lynn Shelton's really good at this too, obviously.
She's
making
brilliant.
That
yeah.
feel so real at the same time it doesn't feel at all like someone's just searching for something to say interesting on the spot. There's something that really comes naturally and honestly out of that. That has to be a very big moment for anybody, I assume, as a stand-up comedian too, but we all have certain circles we run in and to some extent you're always trying to be accepted. Do you remember that moment for you as a comic when you had that moment where you're like, hey, these are my people. I actually belong here. They're not kicking me out of here.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like, yeah, there's a few comedians, you know, Henry Phillips is one of them and my friend Greg Warren and Augie Smith and I feel like there's a bunch – I don't know if it's a single moment, but there's a certain club that I feel like comedians are a part of that has no rules or organization or union. I mean, talk about a group of people who can't organize. Comedians are definitely that, because they can't agree about anything, and everyone's always making jokes, and you know, it just always falls apart. But I feel like whenever I run into comedians, whether we're at a hotel or in a hotel lobby or a comedy condo like it is in that scene, or at a bar, it's like comedians have an instant place to pick up the conversation where you feel like you've known these people for mm-hmm. years, because you have this common experience of, we've stayed in the worst hotels in America. We've performed in the shadiest bars
right.
in front of strangers who hate us. And there's very few people who share that.
Yeah. But there is a great moment in the film where that first night when you're on the road, you're staying at a crappy hotel, you still act like a kid and get up on the bed and jump yeah. up and down and have a good time, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just thrilled. The Backstreet Boys, I wanted that.
Perfect
playing.
Use. Yeah. Probably spent most of the film's budget on getting
yeah,
the rights
90%
to that.
Of the budget is the Backstreet Boys rights.
I figured. I want to close by asking you about one of the visual flourishes in the film. You did bring up trying to tell this story with a camera, obviously on screen. And there is one intricate kind of bravura camera moment where I think it's when you're checking into the hotel and we get that long, pretty elaborate tracking shot. I almost felt like it was the anti-Goodfellas, you know, where instead of going into the Copa and it's all regal and
sure.
look at the VIP treatment, this yeah. is the life of the stand-up comedian on the road checking into La Quinta Inn. So what was your approach to that scene and how complicated it was to pull off that long shot?
Well, we were always looking for myself and my co-director Seth Barish and Adam Beckman, our cinematographer. We're always looking for opportunities to have shots like that mm-hmm. where it was a long take. And long takes are hard, and especially on a small budget, because you're to light an area like that is hard.
Mm-hmm.
And so it, when we were scouting that location, which was at a La Quinta Inn, actually, which is where it takes place in the film, you know, I think Adam was pointing out that, like, you know, there's natural light coming in from here. We could light this here. There's a lot of places to hide light. There's a lot of places to – a lot of ways in which we can hide the camera because mm-hmm. there happened to be a wheelchair-accessible
right.
ramp that
yep.
goes up next
See
to the
reflection.
Stairs.
Yeah.
And so it's almost as though we pulled off this wild studio shot in a location that is real
yeah.
and it feels real. And as we were scouting it, it became clear, oh, this is particularly good for the story because we need to know that the character is walking to the second floor.
Yep.
And so when something happens, I won't spoil it, but that's important to know that he's on the second floor. We already know it because it's,
yep.
it's in the long take. And
yeah.
so we were lucky to pull that off. But even on the day of shooting that, we were like, can we even pull this off?
Sure.
We weren't sure.
How many times did you have to do it?
Did about six times.
Did you?
Yeah.
Well, not only does it serve the story in that way, but that real-time sense of urgency just adds to your kind of – you're in some ways at a low moment. I mean, or you're extremely stressed out at
yeah.
that point, and you're on the phone, and you're it just adds to that sense of how distracted you are and how many things are going on in your life. I think it really adds to
and,
that.
And Andrew Hollander's score does a lot mm. to heighten that sense of stress as well.
Mm. The film is Sleepwalk With Me. Mike Birgit. I knew I'd screwed up.
No, I like that you did. I like. Keep it in, please. Please.
I probably will. The film
Sound
is Sleepwalk.
Out. Sound it out.
Sleepwalk With Me, Mike Birbiglia.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your time. Best cool. of luck with the film.
Thanks. Thanks a lot.
My parents have been together 40 years, which is, yeah, no, but it's too long. But if you're ever in a relationship that's moving toward marriage and you're not ready, don't go to my sister Janet's wedding.